Oh, terrific.
Do we need them?
Come down, but maybe.
Terrific. Well, that's very much.
And welcome to revenue. Sorry, we're a little bit late. Get a couple more members in here. We have a very, very full agenda today. So just to let you all know what we're going to do, we're going to start with our work sessions on 3344 and 2082. Then we'll go to our public hearings on the Senate Bill 548 and House Bill 2181, and then go back and pick up the two bills of work session. Do you have the 3344 table amendments?
No.
Yeah,
we should be.
Well, then I'm not sure we want to start with this if we don't have those amendments.
And basically, all these numbers that Council provided in the bill.
Okay. Well, we can do the rest of the amendments. Okay, we'll start with open up the work session on House Bill 3344. And we have a series of amendments that I want to go through. And Dick, why don't you sort of monitor me as we do that?
All right.
And the first one that I have before me are the 8 and 14th, which I believe we have had testimony and general agreement that since those are in House Bill 2190 that we will not adopt those. Is that generally correct?
I think there may have been some revised testimony with respect to that. Perhaps Dave Carter would like to
do you want to speak to that very briefly?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Dave Tyler, ODOT. I need to apologize. I testified yesterday that we were in support of industry's recommendation that those may not have been needed. We are continuing to work with the petroleum industry on bonding levels and have some potential changes that may be made on the Senate side to House Bill 2190. And at this point in time, I believe we're comfortable with letting the bill go as it is, without Amendments 8 or 14.
Okay. That's what I thought I heard yesterday.
There's still some debate.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm not going to propose those at this point. And we'll probably be back in 5 minutes to see if it's changed. Just kidding. All right. Then we'll go to the -9. And the chair would move adoption of the -C9 amendments to House Bill 3344. Is there any discussion? Objection? They're adopted. Then the -10. The chair moves adoption of the -A10 amendments. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. -A11 amendments. Chair moves adoption of the -A11 amendments. Any discussion? Objection? So ordered. -A12. Chair moves adoption of the -A12 amendments. Any discussion? Objection? Adopted. The -15 amendments. Chair moves adoption of the -A15 amendments. Any discussion? Objection? So ordered. The chair moves adoption of the -A16 amendments. Any discussion? Objection. So ordered. Now we have a choice here, the 17s or the 21s.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Senator Witt?
I would move adoption of the A-17 amendments.
Okay, Witt moves adoption of the A-17 amendments. Has any discussion? Objection? So ordered. Now we have the, this is the next one that's a fairly major issue about the adjustments. The original bill and the 13 amendments would just change the months for the continuing adjustments on the in the diesel tax. The -18s actually implement this new system in July of 2000 instead of January. Call for a analysis between the period of July 1st to January 1st, 2001, and if the revenues are different, more than 5% higher or lower, then the governor shall submit a proposal to the legislature by March 1st to adjust the tax rate or the registration fees. And in my discussions with folks, I think the 18s are the preferred alternative.
Anyway. Chairman, I would move adoption of the A-18 amendment.
Representative Witt, was adoption of the A-18 amendments. Is there any discussion? Objection? So ordered. Now let's see, 19s or 22s. This is the question of whether we want to allow only a 3-day trip permit or a 1-day.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Witt?
I would move adoption of the A-22s. Amendments.
Okay, Witt moves adoption of the A-22 amendments. Is there any discussion? Objection? So ordered. Now we have the -A-20s, which is the Waymaster business. Chair moves adoption of the -A-20 amendments. Any discussion? Objection? Ordered. Chair moves adoption of the -A-23 amendments. Any objection? Ordered. Chair moves adoption of the -A-24 amendments. Discussion? Objection? So ordered. And
Mr. Chair,
yes.
I do not remember who, but one member of the committee asked me for a revenue impact of that measure. it's in here somewhere. The A-25s, correct?
Yes.
These would exempt vehicles, regardless of weight, to travel less than 5,000 miles from the variable portion of the registration fees. And my estimates of that were that there were 200 trucks involved at a cost of about $590,000. But that's partially offset by the fact that some of those were eligible for either sand and gravel or log trucks exemption, so the cost dropped to about $485,000 a year. I'm sorry, $485,000 a year.
Mr. Chairman? Mr. Witt?
I would move adoption of the A-25 amendments.
Mr. Witt moves adoption of the A-25 amendments. Any discussion? Objection? So ordered. Now we have the difference between the 26s or the 4s. 26s are the ones that I suggested that are a policy statement. The -4s are Representative Merkley's that are more mandatory in nature.
Mr. Chair?
In fact, I want, yes, Representative Kapoor.
I move the adoption of the -4s.
Representative Kapoor moves the adoption of the -A-4 amendments. Is there any discussion? Objection. So ordered. And then we have the A30s, chairman's adoption of the dash A30 amendments. Any discussion? Objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, you now have before you a new amendment, the A31.
And that is the...
It would substitute the fees that Mr. Ruffell proposed yesterday, which are reduced in lieu of the fills that, fees that are in the Ian Gross bill. You can look at, if you look at page 24 of the bill, you can compare the fees. Basically, the fixed fee remains exactly the same. And the variable fee is reduced. That's throughout the entire schedule. So if you look at the 78,000 to 80,000 pound category again, which we sort of key on, the fixed fee remains $652.09, and the variable fee drops from $29.49 to $23.12.
Mr. Chairman, let's say, William, can you tell us what this does on a revenue impact?
You should have two sheets, and they may be apart in your packets because there was a little confusion in getting them together for handout. They're titled the House Bill 3344 Revenue Impact Model, and they differ only in the subheading. One says HB 3344A registration fees, and the other fees proposed by OTA.
Okay. Did you have another question, Representative Wayne? Are you in the middle of
No, I found the papers. Now I need to determine what they said.
I was waiting to see if the other members were finding the material.
Okay. We have the comparisons of the revenue impacts. One is a copy of what we got yesterday, and the other is the proposed new fees.
There are some changes a little bit in the one that I provided to you yesterday. That was done late Sunday night, and I had some time yesterday to go back through it and to have someone else look at it and revise somewhat the fuel taxes that would be received as new revenue. It's up from 387, I think it was, to 415, which gives you a pretty good surplus in that first year. So if you're looking at the revenue impact, you've got a $24 million excess there relative to current revenue in the 99-2000 year. That comes about mostly because the weight mile taxes continue to come in and just a shift in terms of when the fuel taxes are imposed. Also relative to yesterday's, I dropped out the 900,000 or whatever it was for diesel fuel tax inventory. Conceptually in discussing that, I think the conclusion I came to at least is that you have a distribution point, which we can think of as a retail service station, and a new distribution point, which is the rack, which is back up the distribution chain considerable distance. What's of concern, then, is the fuel that's between these two distribution points, that's sort of in the pipeline, in storage, whatever it is, at the time the tax shifts from these two different distribution points. Tax is currently imposed at the service station level for diesel fuels, and will now be imposed at the RAC. If you did not impose an inventory tax, essentially all of that fuel would escape taxation that's in the pipeline. So by imposing the inventory tax, what you do is, to the extent that you collect tax on everything that's out there, you avoid that loss. So the danger here is not in terms of underestimating the amount of additional revenue. The danger is that you're going to, as people report voluntarily without very much ODOT's ability to enforce it, their inventories, if they understate those inventories, then some of that fuel through the distribution chain is going to escape taxation. So I've just not put anything in there in terms of additional tax revenue from that inventory tax. What I've done is to have picked that up because I'm estimating diesel fuel tax revenues based on miles that are driven on Oregon roads. Okay, getting to the bottom line then, before we have a problem here again to reiterate in terms of what constitutes revenue neutrality or what it is we're trying to measure. The revenue impact statement is basically a comparison with current law. And the bottom line down here is that this program would raise $24 million more than current law in the first year, and then it drops to about a $35 million deficit. The second way in which you might think of revenue neutrality, as opposed to the revenue impact statement, is whether the vehicles are going to, heavy vehicles are going to raise their cost responsibility share. And so what I put down there then is the reduction from current law that would be required to have the heavy vehicles reach their cost responsibility share. And if you subtract that out of the losses, you can see they fall down into the $7 to $14 million range. The other aspect of revenue neutrality which may come in is the reduction in the cost, the administrative cost by the state for administration of the motor carrier division. All right, these costs are costs that are paid by the trucking industry. They're all in a highway cost allocation study, but 100% is allocated to heavy vehicles. So to the extent that those are reduced, they would offset these losses. And what I heard yesterday is you're getting very close, I think, to revenue neutrality in that context. The second sheet, if you look at the reductions which have been proposed, even after adjusting for cost responsibility, you've got revenue deficits essentially in the $22 to $29 million range with the exception of that first year.
Thank
you. You do have also today among your material fiscal impacts for both of these bills.
And that looks like this. Want to tell us what that does?
For 3344. Thank you. of course, this is the AIM growth version and has not addressed the amendments and will have to be conformed to the bill as it comes out of this committee. But what the fiscal office is showing essentially is position reductions with respect to eliminating the weight mile tax, which would reduce ODOT cost by $5.7 million in the first biennium and $8 million in the second biennium.
Estimate savings either way.
Yes, fiscal does estimate savings, but they're not satisfied with the materials that have been provided to them by ODOT. There are no costs in here from their standpoint, and they've not had time to analyze this yet because they haven't had the material of what it's going to cost to administer a brand new diesel fuel tax. Now, it may be that the positions are there and can be transferred from some other source, but that needs to be presented to fiscal office, and they need to analyze it and evaluate it.
Okay, well, based on this impact, I don't think I would recommend moving the Dash 31s. Assuming this bill moves forward, we can spend some more time on analyzing the numbers for accuracy and any further changes. But at this point, I'd like to move it as written with as the tables are concerned. And so, Chair moves House Bill 3344 as amended to the floor with a two-pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection?
Want to go to a roll call?
Just hold on a second. I'm just trying to get people awake here for a moment. We're listening, Mr. Chair. Okay, further discussion. Now is the time to discuss. Representative Merkley.
Mr. Chair, thank you. This has been a tough decision for me. I came into it with the hope that we could reach a point in which I was strongly persuaded of cost responsibility down the line into the future. I feel at this point we still have some shortcomings on that. One shortcoming is that we don't have any mechanism on the registration fee side, which is the bulk of the funds that are raised, to readjust it if we fall short of our cost neutrality or cost responsibility, revenue neutrality, cost responsibility. The second is we don't continue to adjust for cost responsibility on the fuel tax side either. We freeze it after a few years. These are challenges that could probably be overcome. But they're not overcome at this moment, and I'll be voting against the bill.
Further discussion?
Mr.
Chair.
Well, I can't support the bill either. We heard last week from Mr. Russell about the leap of faith or the on the issue of the new cost responsibility study, and I guess that may be true in that respect. I think as I commented then, that the House Bill 3344 requires, in my mind, just as much, if not a greater leap of faith to make the whole thing hold together. And frankly, I'm not persuaded that we're there. So it's both the mechanical aspect and also the policy aspect. I am still satisfied after hearing this for the past two sessions now, this session and the one prior, that cost responsibility is best achieved by the weight mile tax that we have now. I appreciate the concerns that the trucking industry has about the burden of compliance and cost of administration, but I really do believe that those issues can be better addressed through looking at ways to improve the weight mile system and technology to make it easier to comply with, easier to administer, and less expensive and onerous on the trucking industry. And I would rather see the energy be devoted to that than to replacing it with a system that I am not satisfied is a responsible system at this point in time. I'm not persuaded of the revenue neutrality. I'm not persuaded of the cost responsibility. I still have serious concerns about evasion. And so those major pieces of it just aren't there for me.
Jay Williams. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd simply just echo the comments of Representative Sherley. I will say that I'd like to commend both the proponents and opponents for the work that was done on this bill. For not knowing much about this subject when I came into the building, I think I know more than I probably ever wanted to. But I am in a position, I think, to draw similar conclusions to those drawn by Representative Sherley, both with concerns about revenue neutrality, cost responsibility, enforcement matters, and the overall impact of this. I do believe we know what weight and mile does currently within the system. I am more than willing to do everything I can to help the industry with respect to their concerns about the administrative burdens that they believe that the system puts on them and on the state system. I'm happy to work with that, but I don't think that this is the right solution at the right time.
Further discussion, Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I will be voting for the bill. I think it's the proponents of this bill have done a good job in terms of putting together a bill that is responsible. I think it does come very, very close to revenue neutrality. And based upon different analysis and projections, it may be either over or below current revenue, but certainly it is very, very close. I think from a cost responsibility standpoint, the bill is sound. And I think most compellingly, this bill reduces compliance costs for the private sector. And we had an awful lot of testimony to that effect in front of this committee, that the current system is very burdensome in terms of the cost of compliance. And also, it's very clear from the expenditure statement here that has been proposed that we can make a significant reduction in the cost of government to enforce the current system by eliminating it. I think those reasons are frankly compelling reasons to vote for this bill. I think it's a good bill. I think it's going to help the private sector. And also, it's interesting to note 45 states out of 50 in the United States do not have weight mile taxation. Oregon clings to this system. I think it's a very, very inefficient system. I think this bill gives us a responsible alternative to that system. And for those reasons, I will be voting for it.
Other comments? I would just add that I think the, again, this is my third session dealing with this, Representative Sherman. And this is by far the best proposal that I've seen. I think the industry has put an enormous amount of, I know they put an enormous amount of time and effort into this to address all the concerns that have been raised in the last two sessions and to keep coming back again and again to refine this proposal. And I think they've done it with this particular proposal. You know, we often hear people who say we should be analyzing our entire tax structure and do comprehensive reform and that kind of thing. And I think that's what this represents in this particular segment of our taxation policy. I agree with the opponents of the bill who say that this is not as precise in terms of capturing actual every tiny little variation of impact on the highways. And I think that's a bit of a shortcoming in the bill, although you can have a fair tax, you can have a simple tax, and this weight mile is a fair tax. It's not simple, and this is a simpler tax, and it's probably not quite as fair, although I'm convinced that we have the mechanisms in place to adjust so that it does retain the cost-responsibility ratio between cars and heavy vehicles, and that's the thing that's of greatest concern to me, and frankly, how the heavy vehicle sector collects taxes on itself or pays for itself within that category is of very little consequence to me. And I think the testimony has been that that most folks who are involved in that segment would rather get rid of the weight mile tax and go to registration and diesel tax. So that's why I'll be supporting the bill. Please call the roll.
Senator Sikori.
Aye.
Representative Murphy?
No.
Senator
Rosenbaum?
No.
Senator Kennedy?
No.
Senator
Wells?
Aye.
Senator Blitt? Aye. Senator Rasmussen?
No.
Aye. House Bill 3344 does not move at this time to the floor with the defects. So I close the work session on House Bill 3344. And open the work session on Bill 2082. Dick, we have one more amendment here for this bill.
We went yesterday, Mr. Chair, through amendments 19, 20, 21, and 22. And you now have an amendment 23. And basically that is a rewrite of the A19 amendment. The only change being on page 9, well, beginning, I think, about line 26, the wording has changed there. The dash 19 amendments read, all projects on the lift shall be from the current version of the statewide transportation improvement plan, and the department shall give priority to projects that leverage federal, local, or private funds, or that are intended to generate toll revenue. And that's been changed somewhat. It now reads, all projects on the lift shall first have been approved by the Oregon Transportation Commission for inclusion in the statewide transportation improvement program. The department shall give added consideration to projects that leverage local or private funds or that will generate toll revenue.
I should tell members that this language, this has probably been one of the principal focuses of this bill that I said that I insist that we have a reference to a particular set of projects. We've got all members have a copy of the letter that ODOT Director Krenikin sent to me along with the projects. Those are all from the B list. We don't want to get into a pork barreling situation in the Oregon legislature where each member will bring a special project forward, even though they may be worthy, but I think we do have a process in place with ODOT, with the Transportation Commission. So all those projects were from the B list. But in order to continue to honor the process that we've established, and that is going back out through local jurisdictions, making sure that the traffic patterns that were in place when those projects first appeared still are in place, and that there haven't been other things that have come along, we got into some significant discussions between ODOT and the governor's office, and this language that you see today in the -23 represents agreement on the part of all parties, ODOT, the governor's office, and me, and the legislative assembly, that this language will be acceptable. So that's what you have before you.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Shetland.
Do you want a motion on the -23?
Well, actually, I thought we'd just kind of back up a second. I think we want to adopt the 20s. Which one? This morning. We have another copy of the -23 for Representative Wells. Okay. Chair moves adoption of the -A20 amendments to House Bill 2082. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Now, Dick, tell us the difference between the 21s and the 22s. Again, 21 or 22s are based on ESOLs, and the 21s are not.
The bill, yes, has a blank in it, essentially, for the rate which would be assessed under the road use assessment fee, and it is defined in terms of ESOLs. The contractor has made a recommendation that we move to a table, and keeping that reasonably small, it essentially varies between 6 and 9 axles between 98,000 pounds and 150,000 pounds, and would require that ODOT set the rates consistent with the methodology used to establish those rates for axle combinations and weights outside the table. So that's one amendment. The other is to simply fill the blank with a number which I've essentially to in other words, to keep the tax based on ESOL. The main difference here, again, is that the ESOL is kind of, I think I said, becoming a historical way of looking at road damage done by axle loads. The Highway Cost Allocation Study has moved to using the NAPCOM model, the National Pavement Cost Allocation Model. And the table values come out of that model. So, in a sense, you're moving to a more modern state-of-the-art method of trying to assess these fees.
Okay. Then Chair moves adoption of the -A21 amendments to House Bill 2082. Discussion? Objection? So ordered. And Chair moves adoption of the -A23 amendments to House Bill 2082. Discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Merkley.
Just following up on your comments, I believe you said that this makes reference to the list that was provided to us by Director Finken.
No, it doesn't specifically make reference to that list, but the discussion that we had involved a level of trust and confidence that the process would be proceeding based on this list, and then that the final list of projects as required in these amendments will be presented to the emergency board no later than February 1st, 2000. That gives them time to go through the local process, the analysis of any change in traffic patterns. But again, with agreement that everything that's here will be considered and that this list will come back essentially intact unless there are some dramatic changes on the roads and on the use of them that are specifically observed.
And is the February date set out in the
Yeah, the February date set out in here.
Mm-hmm. Page 9?
Page 9, line 26. The list of projects to be funded with revenues from these bonds will be sent to the Emergency Board no later than February 1st, 2000. And again, it's our discussion that it will be, that this is the starting point for that list. It also specifies on the next page that the bonds for these construction projects will not be issued until the report has been given to the Emergency Board. So this is not a blank check to go do any other projects. My discussions indicated that we as the legislature have to have something that we can point to say, here's what we have funded with this gas tax increase in order to assure our constituents that it's not just going into a black hole, but that we really do have some specific improvements in mind for the transportation system in Oregon.
Thank you.
Any further discussion on the dash 23s? Any objection? So ordered. Here moves House Bill.
I'm sorry. I still have a problem with the bill. That's all. I'm sorry. If you look at page 5 of the original bill, the dash 23 amendments fill in the flat fees for most vehicles, but they omit the flat fee on lines 15 to 23, which is for farm vehicles. You recall I said that we have no DMC and no basis for setting that fee, and I recommended we simply delete it. I've gotten no feedback from that. I did talk with people who are players in that game, and there was no problem in eliminating that. But I don't know. The choices at this point would be to continue the existing $4.55 fee or to eliminate that flat fee for farm vehicles.
And do you have a recommendation?
I would recommend that it be deleted.
Okay, so that would be lines 15 through 23?
Correct.
Okay, Chair removed the conceptual amendment in the original printed bill, page 5.
A.M. Gross. Yeah.
Yes, A.M. Gross, Tough Bill 2082, page 5, to eliminate, to delete lines 15 through 23. Any discussion? Objection? Order. Anything else, Dick? All right. Chair moves House Bill 2082 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Please call the roll.
Aye.
No.
Aye. 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 So 2082 moves to the floor of the due pass recommendation, and I'll be the carrier. I need all your support on the floor, though.
You got it down here.
All right. Okay, we've got it on the record.
The remedial fighters with you.
We close the work session on House Bill 2082.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay, we're now going to move to public hearing. Open the public hearing on Senate Bill 548. I believe there's a sign up sheet for Senate Bill 548. Can you tell us what's going on?
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, Senate Bill 548 is allowing a partial property tax exemption for real property owned or leased by a municipality or port, which is used to clean or decontaminate agricultural commodity cargo. Under this measure, the taxpayer will pay a tax of 0.25% of the assessed value of the exempt property. And this amendment takes place in tax years beginning on or after July 1st of 1999. And I'm just looking at this in terms of the revenue impact. There's one particular case in Multnomah County, and the exemption of this drain clean facility that is owned by the Port of Portland. And in 1998-99, this cleaning facility had a real market value of $3.7 million and an assessed value of $3.6 million. And the property taxes that are currently assessed against that plant are $61,863. So under this measure, the in-lieu tax would be 0.25% of the assessed value, and this would lead to a reduction each year of approximately $56,000. So over the next two bienniums, it's $173,327. So it's uncertain if there's other grain shipping companies that would actually choose to build this grain cleaning facility on the Port of Portland land in order to reduce the property taxes for the facility. We just know of this one particular case.
Okay. Roger Martin and Lost Senator and Bert Farish. They left the room.
No, Bert's here, Mr. Chairman. Bert, we just got your bill, right?
Yes. Morning.
Good morning. Are you ready to?
Yep.
You're on.
I'm on.
Okay. Yes. Well, I'd like to thank the committee this morning for an opportunity to discuss the Senate Bill 548.
Can you give us your name for the record?
Okay. My name is Bert Farish. I'm president of Columbia Grain in Portland. For those of you who don't know who Columbia is, we're a regional and primarily grain exporting company headquartered in Portland. We have an export facility for loading ocean-going vessels at Terminal 5 in Portland on Port of Portland property. Additionally, we operate about 30 facilities and regional offices throughout Washington, Montana, and Idaho. But our primary business is exporting grains grown in the Pacific Northwest, including much of the Oregon white wheat crop, to Asia, the Middle East, the Far East, and Latin America. Why are we here? Well, we're here because Columbia has found it necessary to attempt to clarify a section of the tax code, a property tax code, pertaining to business structures that are located on public properties. As I said earlier, Columbia is a tenant of the Port of Portland, having an export facility on their property. In 1997 and 98, we constructed a grain cleaning system for cleaning wheat, barley, canola, on that property owned by the Port of Portland. Now, we constructed that facility because we are required by our overseas customers to clean grain today, and that's a change in requirements that has occurred in the last few years. Our overseas customers are demanding a cleaner and cleaner product. So now, roughly 50% of our business is affected by this. There are several primary destinations that we clean grain for, that being Japan, Korea, Taiwan, Indonesia, and several countries in Latin America. But the bottom line is that roughly 50% of our business is affected by this requirement, and we could not conduct business as we do without the system that we constructed. In 1998, Multnomah County chose to take what I would call a very narrow interpretation of the in-lieu tax code and disqualified this facility from the in-lieu tax, saying that it was not necessary for loading products. And our position is that it's absolutely necessary to load export cargoes today and will become only more necessary.
as I said earlier, 50% of our business is affected by that these requirements that overseas customers have, and I expect that percentage to go substantially higher in the next few years. I want to stress that this facility is not a processing operation. We do nothing to alter the state of the wheat or the condition that it's in. All that it does is remove non-millable material, that being, you know, wheat stalks or wheat seeds, things that are left over from the harvesting process. We remove that. We ship the product to our customer overseas as a part of their requirements. We clean grain as we load vessels. We clean grain as we unload rail cars and barges and trucks. The county has disputed this position, saying that we should just clean all this grain in the interior, in the country elevators, and that's just really not feasible to do that and meet the requirements that we're asked to meet. Besides it being unfeasible, I mean, there's a huge risk of recontamination of the product while it's in transit. There's absolutely no way that we can guarantee that every rail car in the system will be clean and not have other product in it. In fact, we experience a degradation of the product in the transportation system, and that's not something we can really do anything about. So I'm here to ask your support for this bill. Our position is that it's absolutely necessary as a part of the loading process to conduct our business, and it should fit in within the definition of the in-lieu tax code today. Thank you.
Thank you. Is it you're saying that this was not taxed until 1998?
I'm sorry, what?
This was not a tax that was assessed until 1998?
Well, we didn't complete the system until 1998. Right. And 1998 would have been the first tax.
When you started it up. Yeah. Okay. Gotcha.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Roger Martin, and I'm the lobbyist for Columbia Grain. I apologize for not being here when you called us up. I was outside trying to avoid a $10 payment to the city of Salem for a parking ticket. This, you've been dealing with extremely weighty measures, and to be very honest with you, this is not a very weighty measure. I want to make sure everybody here recognizes we're not talking about something like the intangible tax. We're talking about the definition, a very narrow definition, of a item, a cleaning mechanism, which is built right into the loading facility, which is taxed in the in-lieu manner. This measure has the strong support of the Port of Portland. I talked to Mike Cohen personally about it, the director, general manager, excuse me, and he said not only do we support the bill, we strongly support it, because in order for the Oregon markets to be competitive, you're going to have to do these things to fulfill the requirements of the overseas customers. Most of you do not represent rural areas, so you're not probably familiar with some of the things that go on in the wheat production, but one of my clients, the Umatilla Indian Reservation, has a very large wheat loading facility in the Pendleton area, and I'm always astounded to be over there during harvest time and find tons of grain piled on the ground because the elevator is totally full and they're not shipping it as fast as they can. So in the process of moving wheat from the farmer's field to the shipping facility, you're going to pick up things like gravel and dirt and so forth that have to be cleaned out. I think you would find that all of the agricultural community of the state of Oregon supports this. There is only one facility presently that is affected, and that's this one, Columbia Grain, at the Port of Portland, but the port would like to expand and perhaps have other grain loading facilities there. You're talking about a total cost per year of the property tax of $50,000, which was not collected up until this previous year, and so I would hope, as happened in the Senate, there was no, by the way, there was no objection from anybody in the Senate. I would hope you would be able to pass this bill. Thank you.
Thank you both. Any questions? Okay. Anybody else want to speak on this bill? Senate Bill 548. Don't see anybody. Don, did you? No? Okay, just thumbs up. Okay. All right, close the public hearing on Senate Bill 548 and open a work session.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Williams.
I move Senate Bill 548 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Williams, move Senate Bill 548 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Rosenbaum.
I don't remember what the effective date was of a bill that we passed out of committee.
Okay.
But will this come under, if it should pass the bill that requires the state to make up 50% of lost revenue to local government?
Representative Rosenbaum, this, you're changing a part of the statute that's already there, and so you would kind of be like expanding that definition already there for the Port of Portland as far as what they could have in their facility. So I don't think it would. I think this would still be considered an existing exemption. They're just expanding that particular portion that they can have for the Port of Portland.
Or clarifying a definition.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair?
Yes,
I guess that may be one. I think we left it yesterday that you could continue to work with Ways and Means on some definitional issues, and this may be something to look at in that respect. Also, I just want to know if the Umatilla tribe pays the Portland business tax.
Ooh, you better not go there.
Sales of grain to the...
they're doing business in the city.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to get a bill.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, just in support of the motion, I just say that, I think we all recognize what a huge economic impact the grain shipping industry in this state has, and I think this is a modest revision of an interpretation of the current exemption that I think is reasonable, and I think we ought to show the support with passing this bill before.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Astaflow?
I may be a city girl. Sometimes refer to myself as a city girl, but I haven't had an opportunity to go out and visit some wheat farms and some wheat country during the season. I understand that kind of come to the conclusion that, like law and stuff, there's probably some details about how my bread is made. I don't really need to know. I would be willing to support this bill.
Okay, the motion is to move the bill to the floor with a due pass. Is there any objection? Seeing none, we'll move to the floor of the due pass recommendation. Representative Williams, would you carry the bill?
I'll be honored.
We'll close work session on Senate Bill 548.
Okay. Williams for that. Okay.
What do you have?
I have 248.
Okay.
Okay. And I have 248.
You have both of them?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Let's go to... work session on House Bill 2248 and open the work session on House Bill 2248. And
I was trying to tell them there's more agricultural details.
Okay, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, what I'll do is just first tell you that you do have a dash A9 in front of you, and I just had that amendment made so that it add a little bit of clarity, because after talking to the Department of Revenue, we weren't, exactly clear where this average value of the real and tangible personal property that is used to figure the property factor. So we just put in here the statute of ORS 314.655 just to make it clear exactly where these values are supposed to be coming from. So that's what the dash A9 is. And as you had testimony and last time, there's, various things, a whole assortment of things are changing in terms of particularly the long-term rural enterprise zone property tax and corporate tax credit. And so those are really the major part of this particular bill. And I can just kind of try to give you some little bit more input on the revenue impact, since that's what was kind of lacking the last time.
Right.
To begin with, it's the general 3 to 5 year property tax exemption in enterprise zones. We're now allowing call centers in there, and that was something that we essentially went in and changed. Well, the gross receipts test, so we no longer have that, so that we can now allow call centers to come in. And the economic development has given you quite a bit of stuff as far as there's a 2-page quick summary of the projected property tax impact for a call center. And so that comes out to be about $50,000 per year, $100,000 per biennium, but it's, we're not really sure exactly if and when these call centers would come into a particular enterprise zone. And so I think at the earliest it would be the second biennium, year 2001-03. So that's really the major change there. I don't think the gross receipts test, it could bring in additional businesses because it is making it a bit easier to come in, but, you know, it's hard to really predict if that's going to, it's not going to have a really big impact in the number of businesses. And then in the investment in the rural enterprise zone, the property tax and the corporate tax credit, which, you know, is under a different statute, and be really, if you're a business and you have qualified for the 3 to 5 year property tax exemption, you cannot even apply and get this particular investment unless you've had an addition on it, and then just an additional amount that actually come underneath this longer rural enterprise zone tax credit and property tax exemption. So the first thing we're doing with these statutes is that we're shortening the time frame. Current law allows a 15-year property tax exemption and tax credit, and we're shortening those years for the property tax to 5 to 15 years, so that's something that can be negotiated. And then for the tax credit, it's going from 7 to 15 years. So both of those shortening of the period could reduce the amount of property taxes lost and the general fund money that could be lost due to the businesses getting the exemption and the tax credit. Now, there's two particular ones that we've talked about that were mentioned in public testimony as being potential projects. One's a steel plant in Coos Bay, and the other is a forest product plant in Douglas County. And basically with those two, this major, that they actually could qualify right now under current statutes, and this major is actually giving them an added incentive to maybe even want to come into this program because we're now could potentially be shorting the number of years that they could be in the program. So if they want this exemption and tax credit, they most likely want to come in under current law because they would get the full 15 years. So for those two companies, it's estimated that the property tax loss due to exemption would be approximately $3 million per year. And then a portion of that, again, it goes to the sponsor. The first $1 million, 30% of that, or $300,000, is going back to the sponsor as kind of a tax abatement for these property taxes that are lost. It's to compensate the sponsor. And if you look also at different, another large project that could come in, if there was another project of like a size of $250 million, this could cause an additional property tax loss of approximately $2.5 million per year. So basically that's kind of the, you know, magnitude that when you get these large companies in, you're going to have pretty large reductions in property tax losses. And then the economic development has given you six different pages of explanation and stuff with this long-term rural investment incentives where they've gone into a little more detail and talked about various other aspects of these property taxes. I'm not going to go into that kind of detail, but you have it there if you want to look through it. And the important thing is that there is a particular 30% of the first $1 million of the tax, corporate taxes that the businesses are paying goes back to the rural enterprise zone sponsor. And hopefully with this bill, you also will see then the other local districts that are also giving up their property taxes in the enterprise zones also compensated. But this is not really stipulated in the particular bill. It's just giving that 30% of the corporate income tax revenues to the corporate sponsor.
Mr. Chairman, is it true that this bill does not provide for any of these dollars to go back to special districts
that
may be losing tax revenues?
That's right. It's not clearly stipulated in this bill that it has to go back to all the local taxing districts in which, you know, they gave up their property taxes. It's just going to the rural enterprise zone sponsor. So economic development has told me that that is something they will put in the rules and whatnot, but that is not stipulated in the bill.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
It would seem to me that that's a legitimate concern special districts would have, that they're giving up
tax revenue is part of this process, but only the sponsor recoups those dollars that are foregone from the income tax. And I wonder if we can't get some a conceptual amendment in there to adjust that.
What would you suggest?
That the 30% be prorated out to all governments that had to forego property taxes. Because right now, as I understand the bill, the special districts are foregoing those property taxes, but then they don't have an opportunity to recoup them through this mechanism in the bill. It only goes back to the sponsors, which I believe are cities and counties. The fire districts, park districts, so forth, are not going to be able to recoup these revenues through that provision.
Okay. Do you have some specific language at a specific place? Or is that just real conceptual?
Real conceptual at this moment, Mr. Chairman, because I just noticed that I think what is a shortcoming in the bill, but I think it needs to be addressed.
Yeah, well, I think it could represent what I think you could easily put it on page 10. This is where it's talking about how much is distributed to the sponsors. And you've got an A and a B and a C, and then you could easily put it in there between C and D.
Perhaps Mr. Scott would like to comment. Mr. Chase.
He's out of the room. Oh, there he is. He just shifted chairs.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Bill Scott, Director of the Oregon Economic Development Department. In terms of the concern that Representative Witt has expressed, this would be an issue not just in the bill, but in the underlying law, you know, the way it now applies. And until this morning, this issue had not previously been raised. I believe that the situation that drove the law in the first place was the Nucor steel mill, which was actually, like many of, I guess all of our experiences except the Riddle one so far, was actually led by a port district. And I assume that the local, political leadership had figured out what they were going to do and were comfortable with that. I don't think our department would have any objection just off, you know, kind of without having had a chance to think about it a lot or any reason why the suggestion would be a serious problem, and it would deal the special district a stronger hand in whatever that local negotiation was. But we certainly haven't had time to, you know, really talk through or examine that issue.
Okay. Christian, have any comments?
My name for the record is Art Fish, Oregon Economic Development Department. Thank you, Chair Strobeck, members of the committee. I have no comments except, I think the director's right. This is a somewhat new issue, this bill also still has another house where it will be considered, too.
Okay. Hey, Whit, do you want to show your conceptual amendment again?
Yes, I would, Mr. Chairman. And I believe the correct place to do it would be on page 10, which is section 14. I guess we could either do it in C or create a new section D, but what it would need to say is that the following distribution to all rather than saying enterprise zone sponsors, I think we have to say all government agencies and districts, or maybe Mr. Maneri would have a recommendation.
He suddenly materialized.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, probably if you want to get the money back to all the districts, which would include schools, special districts that lose the exemption money, the easiest thing to do is to put it in the unsegregated tax account in the county. That's the schedule that distributes proportionally the monies out to all the districts. Well, it's easy for the department to send the money to the county treasurer, and they would place it in that account, and it would be distributed automatically that way.
Okay. Is there support for the amendment on the committee? Conceptual support for the conceptual amendment?
I appreciate the direction in which he's going. I wouldn't mind it passing since that's going past the LC. We have the time for it.
Well, House Bill, I don't think we do. So I think what I would suggest, Representative Witt, is rather than, contrary to my original suggestion of specific language based on what Mr. Monroe just said, that we request that staff ask Legislative Council to draft the appropriate language to accomplish your goal, which is to have the partial payment distributed to all local taxing districts, not just to the enterprise zone sponsor. Is that correct?
Yes. And it could go into the unsegregated tax account, as Mr. Maneri suggested.
Okay. Well, then, Representative Witt moved the conceptual amendment to have the partial payment be distributed to all local taxing districts, and if appropriate, that could go into the unsegregated tax account.
Mr. Chairman, but we have to suspend the rules.
Oh, I keep Move to suspend the rules for conceptual amendment. Any objections? So ordered. So, you heard the amendment. Have that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. We're in work session. Any other motions? Okay. Representative Welch moves House Bill 2348 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objection?
Did you want to add an amendment?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes.
A9.
Representative Welch withdraws his motion, and he moves the dash A9 amendments into House Bill 2248.
You're doing good work, Senator.
Any discussion? Any objection? It's ordered. Now, Representative Welch moves House Bill 2248 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? It's ordered. Representative Welch will be the carrier. Close work session on House Bill 2348. And we have two here that person in the real world to speak on 2181 for that one.
Okay.
Coming up in a public hearing on House Bill 2181. Who's is that? Okay. Ed. Mr. Joe Hobson. So this comes from you? Okay. Good morning. Thanks for waiting.
Mr. Chairman, members of the House Revenue Committee, my name is Joe Hobson, Sr. I live in Kaiser, Oregon. I am here to urge your support for House Bill 2181A in growth. The implementation of Senate Bill 1010 from the last Oregon legislature and its potential for regulatory requirements is a major problem facing Oregon farmers and ranchers. That, along with several species of salmon being listed as endangered, means it is important that row crop farmers be supported in the use of farm equipment that will address agricultural non-point source pollution and stream restoration. One example of this type of farm machinery is what I want to talk to you about. Before moving to Kaiser 3 years ago, I farmed for 45 years between Ontario and Mesa, Oregon. During the last 10 years of our farming, we started placing straw in the irrigation furrows by hand to reduce erosion. That practice became too time-consuming and expensive. Farm equipment has been developed to place straw in the crop furrows mechanically. In fact, I built a machine in our farm shop that did the job. That machine is still being used for research work at Oregon State University Experiment Station at Ontario, Oregon. In 1990, the U.S. Department of Agriculture Small Business Innovation Research Cooperative State Research Service provided funds to determine the effect of mechanically applied straw in the irrigation furrows on sediment, phosphorus, nitrogen, and DCPA, or Dacthal herbicide. loss, and the runoff water. Research was conducted at the Oregon State, Oregon State University Medical Experiment Station, Ontario, Oregon. The results were straw reduced erosion sediment loss 95%, straw reduced Dactyl discharge 90%, straw furrows had a net accumulation of phosphorus and nitrogen. In other words, there was less fertilizer in the runoff water from straw furrows than what came in the irrigation water from a well at the experiment station. You will note those in Exhibits 1, 2, and 3 in your folder. It was also documented that with straw mulch, sugar beets can be grown with 36% less water while maintaining the same crop yield, which is Exhibit 3A. This research demonstrated that in a typical four-year crop rotation, straw mulching reduces soil loss an average of 75.1 tons per acre per year, plus retaining the phosphate P and nitrogen fertilizer. Instead of trying to clean up the runoff water with a filter strip at the end of the field, the in-field straw mulching keeps the soil in place in the field. That is a real benefit to the environment. See Exhibit 4. In 1991-92, the Oregon Department of Agriculture funded a demonstration project in Washington County in cooperation with the Washington County Soil Conservation District. It was to see if mechanically applied straw would reduce erosion and phosphorus losses in that area where natural rainfall is the main source of all soil moisture. The results were straw reduced sediment loss by 84%, straw reduced total phosphorus loss in the water and sediment by 94%, you'll note in Exhibits 5 and 6. This agriculture practice has been slow to catch on for several reasons. It is an additional job to do that doesn't have to be done in order to farm as usual. The timing of the practice comes when other things need to be done, such as spring harvest in the during harvest in the fall or during cultivation in the spring. Machines cost money, and the farmer's resources are usually already committed to growing the crop. U.S. Department of the Interior Bureau of Reclamation presented a national award for this concept of straw mulching. It was the Water Conservation Award in recognition of outstanding water conservation achievements. Oregon agriculture is facing difficult economic times because of restricted markets and reduced prices. In spite of that, an example of a farmer that is ahead of the curve in addressing non-point source pollution is Bland Herring of Newburgh, Oregon. In September, he mechanically applies wheat straw in his strawberry fields to clean up the runoff water from winter rains. Not because he has to, it is because it is a good farming practice, and he is concerned about erosion in the environment. You'll notice that in Exhibit 7.
Is that your machine on the back of this?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Non-point source pollution control tax credit should be available to that type of equipment. One of those machines can mulch several hundred acres per season. That would amount to significant water quality improvement. This bill will make non-point source pollution control tax credit available to farmers this fall. It will be for farmers who buy equipment to conduct farming practices that have the potential for significantly reducing erosion, sediment, and fertilizer losses while improving water quality and quantity. The legislative intent of this House Bill 2181, A and Gross, is that the addition of Section 2 to ORS 468.155 is not intended to require industrial tax credits facilities to meet the definition of Section 2 in addition to the requirements of Section 1 and 3 in ORS 468.155 as referenced in ORS 468.165. That paragraph was added to assure that this, if we're talking about just this concept and not in point source pollution. With the passage of House Bill 2181A and Gross, Oregon will be extending a partnership to the farmers and ranchers of this state as they do their part in addressing non-point source pollution and stream restoration. Again, I ask for your support for House Bill 2181, A and Gross. Thank you for this chance. I also have a statement that was given to me to have distributed from Oregon to EQ.
All right.
They wanted, they couldn't, she couldn't be here. She had to be in another spot. And she, and they're in support of this concept along with Oregon Department of Agriculture, Governor's Watershed Enhancement Board, and there is by way of one or two steps, the governor has even indicated his support for this concept to move in this direction.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Hoffman. Any questions? Thanks very much for your testimony. Anyone else here to speak on this bill? Is there a deadline?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I hope I'm not too redundant here, but I'll just go through this briefly, and then there are a few additional comments I'd like to make. House Bill 2181 would expand the Pollution Control Facility Tax Credit Program to include credits for non-point source pollution control. The 1967 legislature established the Pollution Control Facility Tax Credit Program to compensate businesses responding to environmental regulations. Since 1967, the program has been expanded from time to time to encourage businesses to invest in new technologies and processes that prevent, control, or reduce significant amounts of pollution. But specifically including non-point source pollution controls at this time makes sense as farmers are being asked to reduce pollution resulting from agricultural activities. Most water quality improvement efforts in the past focused on point sources of pollution. More recently, urban sources of non-point pollution have begun to be addressed. House Bill 2181 addresses agricultural causes of non-point source pollution by extending tax credits to farmers and ranchers who purchase equipment that helps reduce or eliminate non-point source pollution. An example of this type, I think, that Mr. Hobson has given, that might be included would be equipment that reduces sediment, fertilizer, or pesticide loss from agricultural fields due to erosion. Reducing these kinds of loss will help improve water quality in Oregon. I urge your support for this bill. I would also like to indicate that this bill's consideration in the Water and Environment Committee was very thorough. We basically took a bill that was going nowhere, gutted and stuffed it with this provision. This is absolutely a clean bill now, has the support of DEQ, has the support of the governor's office, does something that's good for Oregon. Our understanding with DEQ is they have extended by rule some credits for non-point source, but they would prefer to have it in statute. I think also people should keep in mind that the whole program sunsets in the year 2001. We do have legislation basically in committee to extend it. I don't know if we'll ever reach agreement on that this session. But these two final years of the program, while the program can still be certified, would be a good probably test to see just how effective these extensions to non-point source pollution would be. The bill has had no opposition thus far in this process. I think it has obviously the support of Mr. Hopkins, has the support of the Farm Bureau, and has the support of state agents. With that, I'll answer any questions.
Okay. Thank you, Representative. Any questions?
Mr. Chairman, if I might state also, Chairman Welch of the Water and Environment was good enough to allow us to get and stuff this bill and give us a clean bill so it wouldn't be attached to anything that the governor might have a different opinion on. I very much appreciate that.
You didn't spread any straw on this bill to clean it up, but it did.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to thank Mr. Hodgson. He came to my office and gave me a very thorough presentation about the work that he's done on this process, and I appreciate him being here and his willingness to go to that effort.
Okay. Any other testimony, comment? If not, I'll close the public hearing and open the work session of Bill 2181. Okay. Representative Wells?
I move House Bill 2181 engrossed as well as a due pass recommendation.
Representative Wells moves House Bill 2181 A engrossed to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Thank you very much. Representative Wells will carry the bill, and we invite you to support Representative Devlin. Close the work session on Bill 2181. Yes?
Just to check, was that a straw vote?
A straw vote.
Okay,
I now will open the work session on Senate Bill 248. Thanks for all your input, Ed. And this bill is a great big bill that revises the farm use statute. John, do you want to, do you have any comment on the dash A2, A3, and A4s?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Don Schellenberg, Oregon Farm Bureau. The dash amendments that you have there are all technical amendments, just little things that had to be done that got missed during the process, and Farm Bureau certainly would be supportive of the inclusion of those amendments.
Okay. Is there anything to add?
I'd just say that, just so that you know, the A4 rolls up to the dash A2 and the A3, so you only need the A4.
All right. That's the deal. Chair moves the adoption of the dash A4 amendments to Senate Bill 248. Any discussion? Any objection? It's ordered. You with this bill?
Yep.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Rasmussen?
Move Senate Bill 248 to the floor as amended with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Rasmussen moves Senate Bill 248 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendations. Any discussion? Any objection? Representative Charlie, would you like to carry this?
I would love to carry it.
All right. You have some farms in your district. The rest of us are all paved.
Mr. Chair, I do have cows. I have cows. I have chickens. I have a farm. And that's a farm in my district.
Okay.
Want to know that I do represent farm people.
Okay, good.
Mr. Chair, I will be glad to carry this, even though this is a bill in which I found absolutely no interest. They took all the interest out.
Right, you did. All right, I'm going to show you be the carrier, and we'll close the work session at Senate Bill 248.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, appreciate it.
Thank you.
Yeah.
We're adjourned.
I didn't even see those
lights.
Oh.